Someone asked me, what if someone just goes through life trying to be good? It sounded so reasonable. How could I be so narrow as to suggest that God could be displeased with someone who was so nice? Why should that person who's trying to do their best, they're doing a great job as parent of their children, they're caring for their own parents in their old age and so on, why should they be sent to hell just because they don't believe? That doesn't sound very fair. I'm sure many of us have been asked that sort of question. Maybe we're asking that sort of question ourselves. And especially so if they've grown up in a part of the world where the gospel has not been available to them. If they've never heard of Jesus, surely it's unfair of God to be angry with them. Well, if you're struggling to answer that question, this passage this morning has some important things to say. This passage proves that God is angry, very angry, with those who've never heard of Christ, and that he is absolutely right to be angry in that way. Well, if that's the case, we need to pay very careful attention to what the Bible says this morning. In the previous paragraph of this letter, Paul has insisted that God rescues all who believe, all who come to Jesus in trusting submission. He has said, verse 16, that the gospel is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. But he rescues only those who believe, and no one else. That is a staggering claim, and it is, verse 17, being revealed as the gospel is preached, revealed that righteousness is from God alone and is by faith from first to last, from start to finish. It's only those who believe who are rescued and no one else. But why? Why can there be no other way? Well, that's what Paul now sets out to prove. Verse 18 actually begins with a little word for, which our translation unfortunately misses out. But put that for in, and then verse 18 onwards is the reason why verse 17 is true. The reason why only those who believe are saved. Our passage this morning is only the first part of that reason, that proof of verse 17. It actually runs all the way through to 3:20, which we'll reach in a couple of weeks' time. But here is the start. Why is God's saving righteousness given only to those who believe? Only to those who come with empty-handed faith? Answer, the wrath of God is being revealed against all the godless and wickedness of people who suppress the truth. There's the reason why only those who believe are saved. Because God is very angry with everyone in the world. The wrath of God is not God losing his temper. Some of us experience that sort of anger and we know how ugly it is. The wrath of God means his perfectly righteous, settled and just fury against sinners. This is not just saying that bad actions have bad consequences. This is saying that God is righteously angry with everyone. It says that it's being revealed here and now, present tense. Yes, there is a future judgment, but already God's wrath is being revealed. Now, Paul's argument is going to be, if you can see it now, you can be sure of seeing it at the end too. But this is saying that God's wrath can be seen here and now. And God is right to be angry because people suppress the truth, verse 18, by their wickedness. So people are not neutral, not simply indifferent, not ignorant. Rather, we have all actively rejected and pushed away the truth about God. That's the charge. That's the accusation that verse 18 makes. God is furious with everyone, and he is right to be so. And in the rest of this passage, Paul shows why that statement is true. Verse Verse 19 begins with the word since. So here's the reason why. First of all, it starts by speaking about the truth we all have. We can't be guilty of suppressing the truth if we never knew it, but that's not the case. Here's the truth we all have. Verse 20. For since the creation of the worlds, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. What does everybody know? Answer, that there is a creator God. The world around us tells us two fundamental truths about God, that he is powerful and that he is deserving of our worship. We've just spent a week sailing on the west coast of Scotland, where the truth of these words were very evident. Majestic hills, awesome sunsets, amazing starry nights. At one point I said to my fellow crew members, how can anyone believe that this is just an accident? Complete silence. A complete lead balloon. Sadly, they're busy suppressing the truth. And God is right to be angry. The same truth is there as we look at one another, as we look at the miracle of a newborn baby. But what has man done? We've suppressed the truth. We've rejected the God to whom it points towards. Some claim that science has explained it all away as a cosmic accident. But actually, science itself depends upon the order and the patterns built into creation. That's just one example of how we suppress the truth. And the result is that, as end of verse 20 says, people are without excuse. No one can blame their upbringing or that dysfunctional family. No one can blame their genetic makeup or the financial pressures that they were under. No one can say, I was never told. Because everywhere we have suppressed the truth. We've ignored the God who created us. And as a result, we rightly face his hot anger. We've all treated God in an appalling fashion. Many will say they believe in God, but it's a God that fits in with them. When it comes to treating him as God, giving him the worship of our lives, we haven't done it. Creation reveals enough of God to make me inexcusably guilty for not worshipping him, not honouring him. Which is the next step in Paul's proof of the charge against us. God is very angry because we've suppressed the truth he has given. And verse 21 onwards, we have not worshipped him as God. For although they knew God, we know enough about God to know that we ought to worship him. They neither glorified him as God, nor gave thanks to him, but in their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. The proper response to the knowledge of God through creation would be to glorify him as God, and to give thanks to him. That is to recognize that we owe everything to him, but that's not our heartbeat. Instead of giving thanks, we grumble. We put ourselves at the centre instead of glorifying God. And that's what the Bible means by the little word sin. A refusal to glorify God as God. Our sins, the things we do wrong, are the outward manifestation of that underlying disease. For some, the symptoms may be more obvious, but the underlying condition is the same for all. Even that nice non-Christian. A refusal to acknowledge God as God. No wonder God is angry. It's massively insulting to take all that he gives, to live in his wonderful world as if he wasn't there. And understandably, God is furious. Perhaps you wonder how a God of love can be so angry. But the opposite of love is not wrath. The opposite of love is indifference. The parent who walks away from their teenager's self-destruction is the unloving one, not the one who seeks to rebuke and discipline. The wrath of God does not deny the love of God. God can't ignore the fact that we have dethroned him. If he did, he would be denying himself. He'd be abdicating his throne. He can't do that. He must remain true to himself. At the heart of the human condition, Paul diagnoses a terrible exchange. Verse 23, we have exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Instead of directing our affections and energies to upwards to our Creator, we've gone in the opposite direction, downwards to created things. So here's a diagram that illustrates that. And that's not just the native in the Amazon rainforest who worships the trees, or those who bow to the image of a cow. No, it's all around us. Such misdirected worship can be seen every week on the football terraces, or the pop concert, or at that modern temple of shopping that is the Trafford Centre. Equally, it's when we look to another person, a particular relationship perhaps, for ultimate meaning. When we make our career or our comfort or our security the thing that matters most. Maybe it's some project we embark on. The ideal home, the perfect family, even some charitable enterprise, which becomes the goal of life to which we devote our time and money and energy. Yes, idolatry is all around us and in our own hearts. We've exchanged the glory of God, giving our worship to other things. Instead of worshipping the Creator, we worship the created. And the result is that we can no longer think straight. Verse 21, their thinking became futile, and our desires are distorted. Their foolish hearts were darkened, so that we don't even realize the foolishness of what we do. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools. We see it all around us. So-called experts who cause such confusion on gender identity. Scandals where the beauty of sexual intimacy has become something abusive and manipulative. Surveys which show the richer we are, the smaller we give, proportionally. And all that as a result of our misdirected worship, giving our desires and affections to created things instead of the Creator. Let's move on to the third stage of Paul's proof that we are rightly under God's wrath. We have suppressed the truth that God has given. We have worshipped other things instead of God. And now Peter moves on to the consequence of that. Verse 24 begins with the word, therefore. This is God's response. This is how God's wrath is being revealed. Three times Paul says, God gave them over. Verse 24, therefore God gave them over in the sinful desires of their hearts to sexual impurity. Verse 26, because of this, God gave them over to shameful lusts. Verse 28, Furthermore, since they did not think it worthwhile to retain the knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do what ought not to be done. That means that the behaviours and lifestyles listed here are not the root of the problem. Rather, they are the result of that misdirected worship of verse 23. When we suppress the truth, we exchange the truth for a lie, then God hands us over to this sort of behaviour, this sort of lifestyle. That is how God's wrath is being revealed. He hands us over to the consequences of our rebellion, hands us over to a godless lifestyle. Now, I suspect that for most of us that requires a big change in how we think. It means that such sinful behaviours are not so much the cause of God's wrath as the evidence of God's wrath. It's how God's rightful wrath, stirred by our rejection of him, it's how that wrath is being revealed as he removes the restraints. As he says, if that's the way you want it to be, then so be it. As he actively hands people over to a godless way of life. There's a sobering symmetry to God's judgment upon us. As we reject him, he hands us over to the consequences. So when we see godlessness on the increase, when there is a downward spiral of depravity, that does not mean that God is dead. It does not mean that God has left the stage and that Christianity has passed its sell-by date, as some would suggest. Quite the reverse. It's a sign that God is taking action. God is acting in judgment upon that society. There's no reason for Christians to despair. Things are not out of control. Rather, God is handing us over. He's actively at work in judgment. Looking at the list of behaviours listed in 24 to 27, there's a focus on sexual sins. Not because the Bible is anti-sex. It isn't. But since we are made male and female in his image, then not surprisingly, rejecting God has consequences for that created order. Those relationships which image God. And he takes homosexual sin as his leading example. Not because it's worse than heterosexual sin. It isn't. But because it's the most obvious expression of disordered desires. The clearest example of God's created order being overturned. I haven't got time this morning to tackle the issue of homosexuality in detail. There's a very helpful little book on the bookstore. Is God anti-gay? But let's remember that this is not the root of the problem. It's simply one example of the consequences of that fundamental problem, our misdirected worship, our idolatry. Nor can we say that there is a direct link at an individual level, as if someone who has same-sex desires is a worse idolater than anyone else. No, that's twisting what Paul is saying. He's saying that the existence of such desires in a society is one part of the evidence of God handing us over to the consequences of our rejection of him. But certainly, any plain reading of this passage is saying that homosexual behaviour is sinful. He could have hardly made it clearer. Why then is our denomination proposing the blessing of such unions? Well, either by ignoring passages in the Bible like this one, or by distorting the plain meaning of what is said. So, for example, Here it's argued that unnatural relations are ones which go against the conviction you feel yourself to be. So suddenly this passage does not condemn those who behave according to their same-sex desires. It's very clear. But it's trusting what... Sorry, it's very clever. But it's twisting what Paul says. Because all the way through, he is the created order in the background. So what is natural is defined by creation, not by culture or custom. Paul's whole argument takes us right back to creation, right back to the will of God revealed in the way that he has made us, male and female. When we get to verses 28 to 31, there's another list of sinful behaviours, further evidence of God's wrath against us. And the list here is more general. What is striking is the mixture. Envy next to murder. Greed alongside depravity. There's no grading of better or worse sins here. Rather, there's a whole range of sinful behaviour. And Paul's main point is that the moral chaos of the world is evidence that God is angry with us, and rightly so. The wrath of God is revealed by the moral chaos of a society. Paul is saying, look at all the messed up world, and you will see that God is angry. He's angry now, and one day mankind will face the full force of that anger. We haven't yet reached Paul's final punchline, verse 32. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do these very things, but also approve of those who practice them. Not only doing those things which we know we ought not to do, they also create a society where those things are accepted and approved. No longer are such things a guilty secret of which I am ashamed. Now they are celebrated and applauded. We see it in the choice of modern day heroes. The entrepreneur who has ruthlessly elbowed out everyone else. The TV personality who has had the courage to come out. The individual who bravely sells their story to the newspaper. Our choice of heroes is Paul's final piece of proof that God is right to be angry with everyone. Could it be that as a society, as a nation, we are experiencing such wrath from God? Seems to me that the signs are there. How ironic if what was declared in the 1960s as a message of freedom, free love and all the rest, throwing off the shackles of the past, should turn out to be God handing us over, becoming more and more enslaved in a godless way of life. Not the freedom that was promised at all. In this passage, Paul has been aiming to show why what he said in verses 16 and 17 is true, that it is only those who believe in Jesus who are rescued, that there is no other way. His answer, because God is rightly angry with everyone, after all, God has made enough of his godness visible in creation, so that we ought to honour him. But we suppress that truth, and we've chosen to worship other things instead of God. We are guilty, and God is right to be angry with us all. We know he's angry because of the moral chaos in this messed up world. How much worse will the full heat of his anger be upon the day of judgment when Jesus returns. Now the danger is that we only apply this passage to other people. The attitude which is rather like those who read about bad behaviour of others in the newspaper, because it makes us feel a bit better about ourselves. So we get to the end of this passage and we say, that's certainly not me. I don't approve of all those terrible behaviours. Not me. But Paul is saying, God is saying, that each one of us is by nature inexcusably under the rightful anger of God. I'm utterly without any excuse. God is very angry with each one of us for how we've treated him, how we have dishonoured and disrespected him. So as we finish, let me take you back to verse 17. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last. That's the good news of the gospel. There is a way of escape. It's the only way there is. A right relationship with God is offered to you, to anyone, as a gift. When you turn to Jesus as Lord and receive it from him with the empty hand of faith. If you've not yet done that, then don't delay. Don't delay. It's the only way for anyone to be saved from the anger we deserve. And if you are trusting in Christ, then let this section, this sober truth, humble you and me afresh this morning. Don't look at anyone else, because only then will we properly appreciate the wonder of God's grace. And then as a church, we will be drawn together as a family of forgiven sinners, equally deserving of God's wrath, equally undeserving of God's grace. This gospel draws us together at the foot of the cross, as we share in the bread and wine, and it spurs us on to reach out with humble urgency to a needy world, to neighbours and friends, because we know that Christ is our only hope.